This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, interesting study published in JAMA Internal Medicine recently, and the results should come as no surprise. Researchers looked at overall health data across 50 states and found that those states that expanded Medicaid or provided affordable health care option for the residents, well, their overall health metrics improved.
One of the most basic tenets of the law was expanding health coverage to the tens of millions of uninsured Americans, many low-income Americans, and that seems to be having a direct impact not only on their healthcare access, but on their outcomes as well, which is really great.
Mm-hmm. Harvard's Dr. Benjamin Summers was the lead author of the study, and his study concluded pretty convincingly that those states with expanded Medicaid or access to low-cost insurance options, those health consumers realized a benefit. They used more preventative care services and were less likely to require expensive emergency care. Pretty interesting findings.
And what's also interesting is that the study compared results in three different states with three different approaches, Kansas, Arkansas, and Texas. Kansas expanded Medicaid, Texas did not, and Arkansas passed a modified expansion version. But the evidence showed that in states with expanded coverage, there was significant improvement in overall health compared to low-income residents of states with no expanded coverage.
But bottom line, Margaret, it really empowered patients to seek more preventive care. And that's the key to improving overall population health.
Whether it's what we think of as primary prevention, preventing things from happening, or secondary, where we find things early and can treat it at a less acute stage of care, always a positive.
Speaking of access to care for all Americans, that is something our guest today is quite passionate about. Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro of the House of Representatives. She's dedicated her life's work to improving access to health care for all Americans. We're looking forward to that conversation.
And Lori Robertson will be checking in, the managing editor of factcheck.org. She's always on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. A baby born with Zika-related microcephaly has died in Texas due to complications from the condition. Microcephaly, an abnormally small brain and head, is the hallmark birth defect connected to exposure to the mosquito-borne Zika virus in utero. The baby's mother had contracted the Zika virus while traveling in Latin America. There have been no reported cases of mosquito transmissions in Texas as of yet. Meanwhile, the warning area for pregnant women to avoid in Florida has expanded from Miami-Dade County and Broward counties to Palm Beach County as well. More mosquito-transmitted cases of Zika being reported along the coast there. Pregnant women in the region are being urged to remain vigilant in avoiding mosquito exposure. OBGYNs are also being particularly hard-pressed to keep steady supplies of Zika testing kits for their very concerned patients. Antibiotic resistance has invoked fears among public health officials throughout the world. It's been linked both directly and indirectly to rampant use of antibiotics in meat production. So shareholders of some of the larger fast food companies are starting to weigh in with their votes. Shareholders at a recent Yum Brands meeting demanded more action from company executives to scale back using meats raised with antibiotics. While Yum's Taco Bell has promised to phase them out by next year and Pizza Hut as well, the same has not been promised for Kentucky Fried Chicken. Shareholders urging management to take action on that measure immediately. Meanwhile, completely antibiotic-resistant strains of bacteria have already arrived in the U.S. in two separate cases. Both patients had been successfully treated afterwards. Public health officials warn this is just the beginning and could be a harbinger of more outbreaks to come. More than half the nation's hospitals are being called on the carpet for high 30-day readmission rates for their patients. Just under 2,600 hospitals will pay a total of $528 million in penalties to CMS for failing to meet new guidelines on those readmission rates. And the NIH is considering lifting a ban on the creation in the lab of so-called chimeras, part human, part animal embryos being created for more efficient biomedical research. There's been a moratorium on creating such hybrid embryos since last September, when the NIH devoted more attention to the ethical implications. Proponents of the measure say it will accelerate the pace of discovery and finding cures for some of the most prevalent diseases impacting human health. I'm Arianna O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro, 12-term incumbent Democrat from Connecticut's 3rd Congressional District. Congresswoman DeLauro founded the Congressional Progressive Caucus, has long advocated for issues such as universal health care, equal pay, campaign finance reform, and saner gun laws. Representative DeLauro served on several subcommittees, including the Subcommittee on Agriculture, Rural Development, Food and Drug Administration. Prior to entering Congress, Representative DeLauro was the executive director of Emily's List. She earned her dual master's at Columbia in the London School of Economics. Congresswoman DeLauro, thanks so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, I'm so delighted to join you.
There's a tumultuous political season that's upon us, but I want to sort of take a look at the sort of the public health issues and thinking that just a number of years ago, I think the world and certainly the U.S. was concerned about Ebola, and now on our own doorsteps, the Zika virus has hit the continental United States. You have had a clarion call that we should really be thinking about this in a much larger context, a permitted health fund. I wonder if you could share with our listeners about how we might be prepared as a country to deal with all of these issues today, but also ones that we're not prepared for.
For me, the thinking around this began with the Ebola crisis, and where we found ourselves really running helter-skelter to look at funds, vaccines, diagnostics, analytics, all of the efforts. And finally, the Ebola crisis was labeled an emergency, in which case we could move resources more quickly than going through the normal appropriations process. You know, we have at the federal level a disaster relief fund so that if we have floods, hurricanes, fires, this money is in a place that can be accessed immediately rather than going through a lengthy appropriations process. Well, it dawned on me, why don't we have a public health emergency fund? We introduced it during the Ebola crisis, and we didn't, you know, succeed. I also introduced it this year, the concept of a public health emergency fund. It would fund existing public health efforts, and it could help us fight the spread of life-threatening diseases like Zika right now. Mm-hmm. And we have not allocated not a dime for Zika. And the president asked for $1.9 billion. The majority in the Congress has not been willing to either declare this an emergency for which we could bypass an appropriations process or appropriate the kind of money that we need for addressing the Zika crisis.
I want to widen the lens a little bit and look at the question of how we fund health research in general in this country. You know, we've had Dr. Francis Collins and Dr. Anthony Fauci from the NIH on the show really bemoaning the contraction of research funds. There's a bill in Congress, the 21st Century Cures Bill, that got some pretty notable bipartisan support, but hasn't made it all the way through. And I know that you support the basic premise of investing in medical research, but you've said that this bill is not the best pathway forward. Tell us about where you think it falls short and what's the better solution to the issue of funding research in this country.
Biomedical research, as you know and I know, has the power to save lives. You know, I'm a 30-year survivor of ovarian cancer. I'm alive today, as I've said many times, because of the grace of God and biomedical research. I believe the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, our nation's colleges, universities, or other research organizations, they're poised to make amazing progress on learning more about disease. 15 years ago, the NIH funded 1 in 3 meritorious research proposals. Today, the rate is falling to about 1 in 5. We are missing opportunities to work for cures for life-altering diseases. And even though last year in the omnibus budget bill, we increased the funding for the National Institutes of Health by $2 billion, even with that, the National Institutes of Health is about $7.5 billion below where it was in 2010. That means that we're losing good young researchers. We're not exploring the depths of disease and the kinds of cures that we need to save people's lives. This is all about saving people's lives. Now, the 21st Century Cures Act, you know, it is aimed at promoting biomedical innovation at the NIH and in the private sector. But it opens a door to under-tested and potentially unsafe medical devices and drugs. The bill urges the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, to approve even the highest-risk medical devices based not on full controlled clinical trials, but on low-quality evidence, like experience of one or two patients. There are troubling provisions on new drug approvals. And that worries me. The Labor Health Education Human Services Subcommittee, in a bipartisan way, we doubled the funding for the NIH in the past. What we try not to do is to earmark where this funding goes. We need to leave the science to the scientists and to the medical community, rather than Congress dictating what kinds of research we ought to be doing. And we have got to appropriate the funds that are needed in order for us to be able to come to those cures and to save lives.
Speaking of priorities, you know, I turned on the TV just a couple of months ago, and there you were in a sit-in. I thought it took me
very
back years, sitting in at the House of Representatives with your fellow colleagues. 34,000 deaths due to gun violence.
Yeah.
And an intractable Congress, it seems. But talk to our listeners, not only just about the frustration of getting the issues through, but lay out some of the laws that you think might have the greatest impact on a reducing gun violence epidemic in our country.
Well, you've coined the right word, Mark. It is an epidemic. You know, it's 90 people die every day. And we respond, you know, when there's an Orlando or a Newtown or Aurora, so forth. But every single day on the streets of this country, we are witnessing people dying from gun violence. It's really tragic, and I'll just be upfront with this. The gun lobby has an enormous control over the Congress. Even though you poll the people in the United States, they want to see common sense gun laws. And I was never more proud, you know, to be associated with an effort. The Senate has a filibuster, and we were very, very proud of our senators, Chris Murphy and Dick Blumenthal. But on the House side, we don't have a filibuster rule. So we created our own effort, and we literally violated the rules of the House. But we sat in to great clarity for the first time in a long time, I think, that members of Congress got their voice about why they were in the Congress, what we were sent there to do, and that's what our job is. And to date, you know, we have not been able to have a vote. You know, if you're on a no-fly terrorist list, well, my God, how can we be allowing you to purchase a gun? Universal background checks. And the NRA used to be for universal background checks, but they have since reneged on it. For me, I want to see a ban on assault weapons. And the high-capacity magazines. I also want, you know, today we are precluded from doing research at the Center for Disease Control on gun violence. We have been hamstrung for the last 20 years. There are some very common sense efforts in which we can move forward. And this is not about taking everyone's gun away from them, but it is about ensuring that AR-15s and other kinds of weapons of this sort don't find themselves in the hands of people who will do great harm. And again, I was very proud to stand with my colleagues in that sit-in. We still have not yet had a vote, but we're not letting go of this issue. I promise you that.
You know, Congresswoman, it's interesting that we talked about two epidemics already, the Zika epidemic and the epidemic of gun violence. And we add to that another epidemic, and that is the opioid epidemic and the deaths by opioid overdosage, either prescription drugs or heroin. We've seen this around the country, 49,000 deaths per year in the country. And the president signed into law the Comprehensive Addiction Recovery Act, but made it clear he wasn't happy with the funding that was available to support the measures in the bill. So we're not sure how the interventions will be paid for. What are you seeing as the most promising solutions and the next best steps to confront the opioid crisis in the country?
The president has made fighting the opioid epidemic a central piece of his agenda. In May, the House of Representatives passed a series of bills that could do some good, but they fall short in providing. There's no resources for treatment or for recovery. We should not have left Washington without addressing this crisis, along with Zika and lead poisoning. The president proposed $1.1 billion. I wish he had, again, asked for an emergency designation so that, again, we could move quickly and move to address the issue and working with states and with cities. One thing I've heard over and over and over again is it's the need for increased access to treatment for abusers and addicts, and the underlying issue of the affordability of treatment programs as a barrier to access, which is one of the reasons why I introduced a bill called the Access to Substance Abuse Treatment Act. It would provide $1 billion a year to support community clinics and expand access to treatment for individuals with a history of substance abuse. The bill has been endorsed by the Connecticut State Medical Society, the American Psychological Association. You could support the innovative delivery of medication-assisted treatment, expand substance abuse treatment to rural communities through the use of telemedicine, treat substance abuse patients as they re-enter the community from the criminal justice system. So, again, these are the kinds of initiatives that help to save lives. We need to expand access to naloxone, make this life-saving resource more widely available. Again, too many barriers to receiving treatment. We know it as a heartbreaking epidemic. It touches every community across our country. So this is such a collaborative effort where federal, state, local government, the healthcare community can make a very, very big difference.
We're speaking today with Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro, 12-term incumbent Democrat from Connecticut's 3rd Congressional District. Congresswoman DeLauro founded the Congressional Progressive Caucus, has long advocated for issues such as universal health care, equal pay, campaign finance reform, and saner gun laws. Congresswoman DeLauro, I think probably 2 months ago, we had Mark Edwards on the show. Mark uncovered the Flint water crisis. But, you know, this is something that is not just limited to Flint in terms of our infrastructure. I wonder if you could talk to our listeners about how we can better maintain our nation's infrastructure and how do we ensure better oversight of the toxins that are making their way into the food and water being consumed in the country.
So accurate. This is obviously a serious problem, continues to be in Flint, Michigan. And that, as we all know, is a government-created disaster. 9,000 children with devastating lifelong consequences. But not too long ago, you know, in New Haven, they identified 2,000 children with lead poisoning. Our homes are some of the oldest in the nation, and they are at an alarmingly high risk for having lead paint. The law about lead in paint went into effect in 1983. And you know, again, that there's no healthy level of lead for the human body, and we need to act to address the issue. I went with the Department of Health, and as of 2013, 2,000 children in the state had lead poisoning. Mm-hmm. 60,000 children had lead exposure. So we have the tools to be able to try to address this issue. This has become a top priority for me. The Centers for Disease Control Childhood Lead Poisoning Prevention Program was cut from $35 million to just $2 million in 2012. And I have fought very hard to have it restored. In 2016, the program received $17 million. We still haven't fully restored it, which is what we need to do, and we have to expand it to all 50 states. And I'm proud to say my colleague, Congresswoman Esty, and I have introduced the Healthy Home Tax Credit Act, The bill provides a $5,000 tax credit to help homeowners remove plumbing that contains lead. You know, and they can apply it to lead paint and dust abatement, as well as radon, asbestos. Radon is the number two cause of lung cancer in this nation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When we look at the problem, whether it's water or whether it's pipes, that's where this gets us into another area of infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
We fall short in the United States in federal investment in infrastructure, in rebuilding. What we need to move forward with, in my view, is a National Infrastructure Bank, which mm-hmm. I suggested in 1994. We're listening to both sides of the aisle and the presidential candidates today talking about investing substantial amounts in our infrastructure. Taking a look at water systems in our schools, in our communities, in the regions, local government can't afford this.
Well, Congresswoman, my first job as a public health nurse in Connecticut, I was working with families affected by lead poisoning, and it is pretty horrible to think that decades later we're still struggling with the same thing. And, you know, I want to pivot a little bit to perhaps a more recent episode in American history, and that's the Affordable Care Act. Now, just about 8 years since it first came into being, a number of the nation's largest insurers are saying they're pulling out of the exchanges because they can't sustain their earnings with these plans. And we've seen such success in millions of Americans accessing coverage on the health exchanges, and maybe they're going to be seeing fewer options next year. We have 20 million newly insured Americans, but we still have millions who are uninsured, and costs, of course, continue to rise. So some tremendous progress, but probably some evolution and some change that we'll see in coming years. How do you see the Affordable Care Act evolving in the coming years? And what's your vision for how it might unfold, perhaps pending outcomes in the upcoming general election?
You know, after 100 years, we addressed our health care system. One of my proudest votes was for the Affordable Care Act, because you pointed out tremendous impact on the lives of Americans across the country. 20 million more Americans now covered. No longer exclusions for pre-existing conditions.
Right.
Annual or lifetime limits on coverage. And I'll just make one other point on this, is because I think the incredible strides that were made for women's health.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, so much of this is unknown, mm-hmm. because there's been mm-hmm. a bad job of talking about the Affordable Care Act and what it includes. I think one of the things we have to stop doing, and the majority in the Congress has to stop dealing with this, is to try to repeal the Affordable Care Act. When you implement a system as big as transforming our health care system, what are the unintended consequences? And look at how one can address that. You know, when Social Security was implemented, there was great concern that it would never be able to work because so many people had the same name. How would they be able to get the right payment to the right person? Long and the short of it, I don't think anybody would talk about repealing this Social Security today. What we need to do is to take a look, as I said, at some of these unintended consequences. And you know that my colleagues have voted more than 60 times to repeal. We have to address the issue of the cost of premiums, which have gone up. We have to address the deductible, giving every state the choice of a public option insurance plan, allowing individuals below the Medicare age to opt into the program by providing the option to those who are 55 and older, the rising cost of prescription drugs. The other thing is we have to increase funding for primary care services. This is an investment. What we need to stop doing is relitigating the Affordable Care Act and look at those areas where there have been unintended consequences. How do we make it stronger, tighter, make it more affordable? The insurance rates going up, one has to take a look at whether or not those are justified.
We've been speaking today with Representative Rosa DeLauro. You can learn more about her work by going to House.gov/DeLauro, or you can follow her on Twitter at Rosa DeLauro. Congresswoman DeLauro, thank you so much for joining us and for the great work that you do.
Thank you.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
In an economic speech, Donald Trump resurrected an old GOP talking point, claiming he'd save 2 million American jobs by repealing the Affordable Care Act, That's a distortion of a Congressional Budget Office analysis. The nonpartisan CBO did not find that the Affordable Care Act would cause a loss of 2 million jobs. Instead, it found there would be a decline in the amount of labor workers choose to supply in response to mainly the insurance expansion provisions of the law. Republicans have been distorting this finding from CBO for years. A version of the claim made an appearance in the last presidential election 4 years ago. What CBO has described is the reaction of workers to getting subsidies or a guarantee of not being rejected by insurers because of pre-existing conditions. That guarantee of coverage and a limit on how insurers can price policies based on age could cause older workers to retire earlier, CBO found. And those with income-based subsidies effectively have a boost in income, so they may not need to work as many hours. They also may not work more hours because the additional income could lower the amount of insurance subsidies they receive. CBO also found there would be some reduction in the supply of labor due to a Medicare payroll surtax on those earning more than $200,000 a year or $250,000 for couples. The total reduction in the supply of labor is equal to 2 million full-time equivalent workers in 2025, CBO said. As then CBO Director Douglas Elmendorf explained in a 2014 congressional hearing, CBO doesn't use the term lost jobs because there's a big difference between people who want to work but can't find a job and those who decide not to work on their own. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of factcheck.org.
Factcheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have factcheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. For all the people in the world without limbs, acquiring prosthetics can be costly and out of reach. It's especially challenging to make prosthetics for children since they are in constant state of growth. Rochester Institute of Technology scientist Dr. John Shul stumbled upon a clever and affordable solution, provided online open source templates to anyone anywhere in the world who has access to a 3D printer, and provide prosthetic hands for next to nothing.
I've made this Google Maps mashup. If you have a 3D printer and you'd like to help, put yourself on this map. And if you know someone who needs a hand, put yourself on this map.
So he founded the Enable Network, which has massed thousands of volunteer makers, providing cheap but functional prosthetics for children in need.
I think we're currently pushing 5,800 identified members in our Google Plus community, and we have followings in the thousands more. We know that we've delivered about 800 hands devices, and we suspect that a comparable number have been downloaded by people we can't track because we put all of our design on the internet.
The movement has grown so rapidly, the simple limb designs have become more sophisticated as recipients of the prosthetic devices provide feedback for designers to make more efficient devices.
We're still working on opposable thumbs. We're still working on individual finger movements. These things grip or ungrip. That's all they do. So they're much less functional than a biological hand, and they're also less functional than a fancy myoelectric hand. But for kids, it's huge because those expensive devices are typically out of reach for children who would outgrow them. So it doesn't make sense for them to get a $5,000 or $10,000 hand. And, you know, our hands don't even pretend to look like regular hands. They look like superhero Iron Man hands. And for that very reason, they're very popular with kids.
Enable, a global collaborative network of open source designs, linking to makers with 3D printers to provide low-cost prosthetic limbs to children and adults around the world who might otherwise not be able to afford them. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.